Hey everybody, this is Neil Berg, producer, composer, lyricist, kind of nice guy, and I was thrilled to be here with Dave Lefkowitz on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Saturday morning, and happy to be talking to someone actually in person for once, not one of the many myriad of wonderful phone calls that we've had, but someone I can actually look at face to face and have a real conversation with. His name is Neil Berg, and he is a composer for the theater, and he's also a producer, and if you know him around these parts, it's just that he just did a concert that he's been doing for a bunch of years now called, well, it was 100 years of Broadway. Now it's 103 years of Broadway that he brings around the country. He just brought it to the Union Colony Civic Center here in Greeley, Colorado. He's also working on a show that will be at the Denver Center next coming season. So we've got a bunch to talk about with composer-lyricist Neil Berg, and welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here. So tell us, first of all, even though it's already come and gone, but it'll probably come back, and you bring it to New York quite often, what is 103 years of Broadway?
I always say, you know, our staple show is 100 years of Broadway. We bring the great singers, the stars of the Broadway stage. All of our performers have starred in many of the famous shows, you know, Phantom of the Opera, Les Miserables, Wicked, and the list goes on and on. And every time we go to a venue for the first time, we bring our staple show, 100 Years of Broadway. So sort of every time we go back to the same venue, we just add a year just to let people know it's going to be a little different. So basically 103 years means we're coming to that venue for the fourth time, 100, 101,
102, 103. Broadway started before 1914, so, or 1911, so it's still, yeah, it's kind of a, what is the makeup of it? Like, what is it? It's a review.
Yeah, I always say it's much more than a review. It's a review at its heart. But basically, what I do is these singers, I always gear the show to the stars we have. So if we have the star of Wicked, you know they're going to be singing from Wicked. And if you have the star from Phantom, so on and so forth. So, and most of these stars have starred in more than one Broadway musical. There's a lot of material to cover just for them alone.
Sure.
But then I go back and I look at the history of Broadway and play the guessing game. If that star was around in what decade, what famous show would they probably be starring in?
Oh, nice. So can you give us like a specific example of a star and how you would tailor that production to there?
Sure. Yeah. So for example, let's take Chuck Wagner.
Okay.
You know, one of the great baritones who's, you know, was the first ever Jekyll and Hyde, you know, ever. You know, before it was on Broadway, he was the one who started it with Frank Wildhorn and then took it into its development phase. So he's also been the Beast in Beauty and the Beast, and he's also done Lancelot and Camelot. You know, so we have a lot of territory to cover because a lot of them have done revivals.
So you could pull him back to Kiss Me, Kate, maybe.
You read my mind, Dave. So we'll take him back to, you know, Where's the Life That Late I Led, or we'll go back even, you know, to some of the other great baritone or big baritone Alfred Drake roles, you know, or maybe something like Howard Keel, or even, you know, Man of La Mancha. He'll do for
us. Of course, sure.
So it's just for people to get a sense of that he can do and probably would have done those roles if he was in that era. But even going further than that, as the narrator of the show and the Broadway fan and historian, I get to tell behind-the-scenes stories that most people don't know about either the song that we're doing, the show that was written, the performer, or the composer. Because for the most part, I'm either colleagues or friends with a lot of the composers who are working today. You know, I'm friends with Frank Wildhorn. I am a good friend of Maltby and Shire.
Wow.
You know, I've worked, you know, I know Stephen Schwartz who wrote Wicked. And they're colleagues in New York.
Sure.
And so, you know, I get some tidbits and information. And I think they really enjoy the fact that I go around and do this. They all know I'm doing it.
So it's music, it's history, and it's trivia all surrounding. How long have you been doing it?
Well, on tour, we've been doing it on national tour for, this is going to be our 10th year.
Wow.
So a decade. And we thought, you know, at the beginning it was going so well. I asked my co-producer, how long do you think this will go for? And he said, oh my God, this is a big hit. We're going to go for at least like 3 years. But it just, people love Broadway. And not do they just don't love Broadway, but our show brings back the memories. People come up to me after the show and they remember who they were with when they went to see Men of La Mancha for the first time, or they have that fond memory of listening to the cast recording with their parents growing up in the house. I can't tell you how many older people come up and tell me they were there, Oklahoma, you know, and so...
Fewer by now.
Yes.
Yeah.
But trust me, it goes all the way back. And in our show, you know, I say 100 years of Broadway, we'll go back that far. We'll go to, you know, the 1900s, George M. Cohan. We might start off with Give My Regards to Broadway. And we'll do, you know, a Irving Berlin song.
Because most people think it sort of starts with Showboat, but it really doesn't.
No, and yeah. Showboat's a landmark musical. I talk about Showboat in my musical when we do the Rodgers and Hammerstein segment, right. Because most people don't realize that Oscar Hammerstein was very famous way before he met Richard Rodgers by writing with Jerome Kern, Showboat in 27, landmark musical. And Richard Rodgers was, most people know, very famous before he ever worked with Oscar Hammerstein with Rodgers and Hart. But I don't know if everybody knows that it was Richard Rodgers who brought the idea of Oklahoma to Lorenz Hart, and Lorenz Hart wanted no part of it. And so,
Why not?
Well, he wasn't doing well mentally.
Oh, that he was probably
physically, yeah. So he needed somebody to write with. So we went to Oscar Hammerstein, who in the late 30s had not had a hit musical in years. So that whole new era of Broadway with Oklahoma starting with Rodgers and Hammerstein was really that. You know, it was, they were both famous way before, but they took off to a new beginning. And then World War II happened, and they were able to write musicals that have more serious themes. And Rodgers and Hammerstein are known for...
Well, Carousel was... That was before World War II. That was... When was Carousel?
No, it was in the early 40s.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and so it kind of coincided with it. But most people don't realize that. At the heart, Carousel is about a man who kills somebody, who beats his wife, yep. And he's looking for forgiveness. That was a hit musical in the early 40s.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. By the way, we're talking with Neil Berg about his show, 103 Years of Broadway. And before we talk about your other projects, I still want to get a sense of the logistics of touring a show like this, because it's one thing to be in New York and go to Town Hall or wherever you do it there, and because I'm a New Yorker myself. And you know, the actors are all there, and you can, I don't know, how an orchestra or pit crew do you normally have? Like, how many...
Well, it depends where we are. It depends where we are. Yeah. But on tour, we want to give a sense of a mini orchestra, so it's usually four or five pieces. But we play much larger than that because, of course, you know, there's no way around it. We cheat. You know, because just any time you have a keyboard, you can add a string section, you know, because it just fills it out. But everything is live. We do not play to track at all. I'm against that 100%. It's all live musicians. It's just a big full sound. Yeah.
The audience can't see that. I'm giving two thumbs up for using live musicians. Yes. But do you travel with everybody, or do you pick musicians in Denver or when you come to Colorado? Or you go as a group, even the stars, the singers of
the
show?
Our Broadway tour kind of tours a little more like a rock and roll tour in a sense. But if we have
a bus?
Five, we used to have a bus, absolutely. But that got a little crazy, so we changed
all
that.
Those Broadway people.
Those Broadway groupies, wow.
Yeah.
But the truthfully, when you're traveling with five singers, and I always take five because, you know, just in case somebody gets sick, then you still have the four are covered. You know, I always would at least want four. So five.
So you have an understudy, or do all five?
No, all four. All five perform.
Yeah.
So, and I probably, out of the thousands of performances we've done, maybe once or twice we've ever had somebody call in sick. So that's great. And with the musicians, you know, we travel with and we're tour manager. We're up and out. You know, so, sometimes we'll sit in a theater for a week. You know, we've done the Broadway sit downs, like we're going Celebrity Attractions in Oklahoma City and Lubbock and Amarillo, and they have season series that will sit down for a week, you know, at various places. But for the most part, we are on what I call the Tony Bennett circuit. You know, the PACs, the Performing Arts Centers. So one night Tony Bennett will be there, and the next night, you know, somebody else, a star who plays 1,500, 2,500 seat theaters, and then we'll be there in that market. But yeah, so it's a lot of traveling, of about somewhere between 80 to 120 shows a year. But we bring everybody from New York. We don't pick up a soul on the road because we really want it for the audience to have that experience of seeing a real show.
Yeah. Do you ever feel hamstrung by the fact that your audience is probably going to be mostly 50 plus, and that you're going to be playing the hits to somebody? I mean, yes, you're tailoring. If someone was in Wicked, you're going to do Wicked. If someone was in A Change in the Air,
I might not do that unless I really thought the song resonated. For example, I've been traveling a lot recently with Jeanette Bardell. Now, Jeanette, yes, she was in Rent and she was in Hair and sang the big solos in those shows, but she just recently starred in The Color Purple on Broadway, taking over for LaShawn's. And so when you have an extraordinary voice like that and the song that she sings is the big 11 o'clock number, then it's important for me to let the audience see her do it. And even if no one's seen it, I think that's even better because they get to discover what was going on Broadway. But I'm very careful. If there's a song I know the audience doesn't know or won't recognize right off the bat, I'm very careful of which ones I select to do that. So yes, it's mostly the hits. But then again, I'm catering this really to my mother. And what I mean by that is Broadway musical theater fans who don't necessarily live in the business, who aren't going to Joe's Pub to see the cutout songs of Sondheim.
Oh, yeah.
I want people to come and experience and share the love that we have for this American art form. And I'm hopeful that people who, live and breathe and work in theater, they come, they understand, they respect, they love what we do. How can you not? It's the talent. But I'm really catering to that 99.9% of the other people on the planet who just love musicals, who don't mind hearing, a Jersey Boys song. For example, for a fact that if you go into New York and if you play Memory from Cats, the people in our industry are going to frown, scorn.
If you audition with it, it's going to be like, come on.
But yet, people who come to our show, if we have the star of Cats, who we have, Carter Calvert, or somebody who starred in it, Natalie Toro, my point is,
or She Does Amiga or something. Yeah,
there is a reason that song Memory was a big hit. And when you see it done by the star of that show with all the acting and the intent and the storytelling, it's not that lounge song you hear that most people hear. And I want people to understand there's a magic to Broadway. It's the story, not necessarily the music or the voice. It's the story, which in layman's terms is the acting.
Oh, nicely put. Now, moving away from this particular review, and we are talking with Neil Berg, who is also a composer yourself.
Yes.
So you've been working on a bunch of pieces. You had Prince of Pauper off Broadway. In fact, we're opening and closing the segment with a song from Prince and the Pauper. But you're working on a bunch of other stuff. For example, a show that's going to debut here at the Denver Center called The 12. Now, I assume that's about the 12 apostles. Aren't you a little worried about doing a rock musical about the Bible? It's been done. In fact, that story's kind of been done.
Actually, I will tell you that what's wonderful is that this story's never been done. And not only has it never been done, it's never been looked at, which is why everyone's so excited about that. And I'll get into detail.
And aren't you Jewish, by the way?
Well, so were the 12 apostles.
Fair enough. Okay.
So just to let you know, I'm collaborating with Robert Schenken, who's truly one of the greatest writers in our country. He just won the Tony Award for writing All the Way, starring Bryan Cranston. He won the Pulitzer for the Kentucky Cycle. So we both have this fascination with, not just this religion as a whole, but the 12 apostles, metaphorically for us, you could take it any way you want it. And we want people, if people are going to bring their own story, their own self-worth, whatever it is, to the story. Mm-hmm. But if we take what Jesus was doing at that time, it was a revolution. And so,
if you believe he existed, which I'm not so sure.
Correct. I'm just saying, if you take the story, that's what I'm
saying. The myth, quote unquote. Yeah.
Correct. Some people believe, it's not a myth. Some people believe it's a myth. But we're talking about just the fact that the story was a revolution, because here's somebody who's opposing the Roman regime at the time.
Sure.
And so what we're really asking people to look at in our story is that what happens when a group of people are following a leader, they give up everything for that leader, and the leader unexpectedly is killed.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Do you go back to your lives? Do you go back to the safety of that? Or what makes you go on? And what propels you to then create the biggest revolution in the history of mankind? So, you know, you could be talking about other revolutions that happened in history, Che Guevara, and, you know, and what happens when your leader's cut off. But the other thing about this that's so exciting about the 12...
Actually, Lin-Manuel Miranda will probably write a Che Guevara.
All right.
Yeah.
But what's so thrilling about this is that these 12... We'll talk about it. 12 guys, and actually a couple, and one woman, because Mary Magdalene was around.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And we actually have, you know, Mother Mary was around at that point.
Oh, still, right, of course.
So what happens is they're hiding out. This is right after Christ is killed, and they're being hunted by everyone. If they're found, they're going to be killed. They go back to where they had the Last Supper, their Passover Seder.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out what to do. It is utter chaos. It's paranoia. What are you going to do? And all we know is that between the time of the crucifixion and the resurrection, they decide to go out and continue. What happens in that room? Not a lot is written in any of the Gospels or Bible about that time.
12 angry religious men.
Well, that's exactly what I was getting to. It really is like 12 Angry Religious Men, the musical. It's a powder keg in there because it's claustrophobic. It's sweaty. These guys are labor... as people see them in paintings, but they forget these were fishermen, right? They were laborers. You know, you had a tax collector in there. And then it's up to conjecture what maybe the other couple that nothing's written about them are. So... and then you have Robert Schenken writing the book.
But you also have to make a decision of what genre and what style. It's a rock musical, right?
It is. And rock music is the best to do this because rock at its essence, you know, if you go back to Andrew Lloyd Webber, why did Jesus Christ Superstar work so well? Because when you have a revolution, you want to scream. You want to have the highest intensity of music that you can have. When you compose for theater, You write. The music comes in mostly when the emotion is heightened the most. Love, anger, hate. That's when you can't speak it anymore. You sing it.
Right.
So rock music is at its rawest. It's most angst-driven. And it's most honest, I would possibly tell you.
Did you have any training? Did you do BMI workshop? Did you do NYU? Or what was your background in that?
Yes. When I went to college, I studied with... Sue Peters, and I went to Binghamton. I actually went to play baseball.
Oh.
But when I was studying music, Sue Peters was in charge of our department, musical theater, but Lofton Mitchell was there, who wrote Bubble and Brown Sugar.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So I worked with them. They mentored me while I wrote my first musical there. I also worked there with Walter Ponce, who's now is the head of the piano faculty at UCLA.
Okay.
And then when I got out, I auditioned and got right into the BMI workshop. So, you know.
Was Lehman Engel still there? Or?
No. He had gone. Skip Kennan, and I studied under Maury Yeston, the great writer of Titanic and Nine and the other Phantom.
Yeah.
So I learned a great deal about craftsmanship, of how to write a musical there. And a lot of guys came out of that. You know, Lynn Ahrens had already hit with Once on This Island.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she was there as one of the mentors. She actually auditioned me at that time. But, you know, Bobby Lopez, who wrote Frozen, came out of there.
Yeah.
And, you know, many, many more people came out of BMI and these ASCAP workshops. You know, anybody thinks they can write a musical, but the truth is anybody can sing because we all have voices, but there's a craft. And I implore anybody who wants to do this, it's about learning the craft. For example, and I'll give you one example, not many people realize that the second song of every musical, maybe the third.
Is that the I Want song?
The I Want song.
Yeah.
So it's a manipulation. The writer, basically, you musicalize what the lead character wants. So the audience can then take that journey. They invest. They want to care about this character. And so after the opening number, you need that. And if you name a musical, you know, obviously Pippin, Corner of the Sky, even, you know, I Want to Find My Corner of the Sky, you know, you can go any musical in history.
I want to be a producer of a great band. Right, yeah.
And a lot of times they'll just come out and say it like that.
Yeah.
I want, yeah.
So, but... you've been in this game for a long time. This, I guess, is your bread and butter, is the touring and the one-on-one production. Not one-on-one production,
excuse
me. 100 years of Broadway. But has it been frustrating in the sense that you've had a couple of off-Broadway presentations, but do you feel sometimes like you're banging your head against the wall, that somehow it's Aaron's and Flaherty get on Broadway? It's, you know, Sondheim even has to looking back on Broadway with a new show.
No.
Just of trying, you've been in the game for a very long time.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, it success is how you measure it, okay? For example, you know, Jill Santoriello, who I knew, had written one musical, and were 20 years, 25 years, and finally, only one, and got it on Broadway,
Tale of Two Cities, yeah.
Which lasted a month.
Two, yeah.
And then, you know, so in me, I think that's a huge success, just getting there to play in the major leagues.
Yeah.
But for myself, look, I've gotten to write, you know, The Prince and the Pauper, which ran for a couple of years. I've written Grumpy Old Man, that opened at the
What's
Royal Theater.
What's happening with that, brother? Yeah.
It opened at the Royal Theater in Canada. But, you know, these things, they're not in your hands.
Right.
I had a chance to write, you know, The 12, which has been an amazing success. Because I get to write, you know, not only do we get to do the workshops and you're the creative part of it, mm-hmm. but, you know, the fact that it's opening at the Denver Center, which I call the Yankees, the New York Yankees. I know people might not like this reference here, but...
Better than the Mets.
Okay, but what I'm saying is that it's one of the best, if not the best, regional theater in the country.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of merit to that. Getting to Broadway is a whole different thing. It's a political game because, you know, most people don't realize that not only do you need money, but you need, there's only three or four landlords who own all the theaters, and they have to figure out a way if they're going to make money off that.
True.
And so that's the kind of the dirty little game that's played there. So how do you align yourself? I hope none of them are listening to this. But I like them all. They're all great.
We love them. We love them. Yeah.
But, you know, my feeling is that you don't go to Broadway. Broadway comes to you. You know if your show is doing well enough or gets that sense of momentum, it'll make it. And that's why a lot of musicals that end up on Broadway mm-hmm. that don't last, they probably were brought there too soon or not ready to be there. Yeah, most people know that. But, hey, better to take a big swing and miss than not swing at all.
Oh, heck yeah. Oh, heck. And the fact that you're keeping doing it and the fact that you've still got the fire and the passion and to do it regionally and to do workshops and to go through all that with shows like The 12 and with Prince and the Pauper and what's that? Oh, are you working on Blondie?
Well, I was. I was working with Dean Young, who wrote the, you know, his father started Blondie the comic strip, and then Dean took it over in the 60s. So we were working on that. We're on the respite, so we're going to see how he wants to do with that. But, yeah, I did start working with him on that.
And you've been doing film.
Yeah, I have. You know, I did a couple of what I call major independents. They've been released, you know, with real actors, you know, so
sure.
It was great. Once Upon a Time in Brooklyn was the last one that just got released. It, you know, it had, you know, Kathy Moriarty was in it, and Vinnie Pastore, and some of the great films.
How long does it take? I can't even think. You just go into a screening room with the footage, or you bring home a DVD, and you just sit there at a keyboard, or what is the process?
I usually get brought in last in it. Mm. And what happens is the director will come in with his film, and the editor will usually put what's called a temp score. So they'll take any music they want from history. They'll have everything. And they'll temporarily score it. And then I will sit down with the director, and I will go cue to cue, line by line, scene by scene, and we will talk about if we want music here. And then we want if it's original composition or if we want source material. So, and I've done both in the film. So original music, obviously, you sit down, and then you get it on a video screen, and then you go to work. You start scoring to the action. But, you know,
Arrange for an orchestra. You can do that part.
I can, and what I feel is that when I'm working on the keyboard, a lot of times composers will work on keyboards in a video room. And then if they are lucky enough to have a budget for an orchestra, then the orchestrator will orchestrate it for
them. Or there's somebody else who,
I mean, some people do it themselves. Some people orchestrate out. I think that there are people who do that better than I do. So I have no problem. But, for example, for The 12, my musical, mm-hmm. Let's start here. When I did Man Who Would Be King, which is another musical of mine, which is actually being done in Buffalo right as we speak, I would have access to Larry Hochman, who's one of the greatest orchestrators in the world. You know, Book of Mormon is one more Tony's. So I knew I wanted that big symphonic sound. I gave it to him. I did the same thing with Grumpy Old Man. I gave it to him. But when it came to The 12, my rock musical, look, I used to tour in rock bands. I know rock music. I know how to score for rock music. So I wanted to be authentic. So I did that myself. And I got Wendy Bobbitt Cavett, my musical supervisor, basically, to be my co-orchestrator, because she can do some arranging, but she actually is just much more adept at typing it into the computer than I am.
Sure. Last couple of questions for Neil Berg, and remember to be on the lookout for 100 years, or now you're calling, depending how often you've been to a particular place, 100-something years of Broadway.
I like that. Maybe that'll be the new name, the 100-something years.
Yeah, like 30-something, 100-something years, and also the pieces that he's working on, and the 12 coming to Denver. But one thing I'm curious about, that you've been a conductor and musical director, and you have worked with huge major stars, even if it's for one night, everybody ranging from Brian Stokes Mitchell to Betty Buckley, Rita Moreno, Ben Vereen. Anecdotes, positive and negative, and you know, if they're dead, that you can be negative. but any great stories, any great anecdotes about people that you have been in a pit for?
You know, everybody's different. That's all I can tell you. And I really believe that if you come in and just be kind, you know, it really diffuses everything.
Oh, okay.
So I've heard the stories about certain people in our business. Some people have tough reputations. So, you know, but I'll give you this story. You know, Betty Buckley, who has one of those reputations of being tough to work with. Why? Well, you know, in her defense, she's very particular. She wants it to be right. She's a perfectionist. So if it's not perfect, she will let you know it.
Right, well, yeah.
But I diffuse that. By, you know, so I'll hire a second, you know, I instead of just having her assistant and the stage manager, I hire the stage manager just for her, just to take care of her. She appreciated that. And then, you know, I want to make sure I'll sit down with her and say, Betty, this is what the client wants on this particular concert. I know this is what you want, and you'll talk it out. And it's just about caring and showing people you care. When you just start enforcing, you'll find people can be really nasty. So to the end of the story is that I love Betty. I believe Betty loves me. And, you know, we've always had a great working relationship, you know, whenever we've had a chance to work.
Is there someone you would never, ever work with again unless you're paid, you know, X gazillion dollars?
You'll hear this story a lot. I think that the people who are at the top of the food chain are nice, easy, wonderful people. Mm-hmm. It's the people who basically haven't really gotten it, or maybe are on their way down. The people who have something, there's something else going on in their life. Those are the ones that, for some reason they get nastier. But I really don't want to give a name, not because I'm being kind.
Initials.
No. I can't do that. But I will tell you some of the wonderful things that I've noticed. You name the people that I've worked with.
But you can list more.
Rita Moreno. First time I worked with her was in San Francisco. She was going to be a special guest on my show. And she walked in. Now, you have to understand, while she lives in the Bay Area in California, she's a New York girl. So my drummer was setting up his drums. And Rita, if you're listening to this, which I don't know how you will, you know, forget
me. Well, on the internet, yes.
Okay? So he's playing his drums. We hadn't met Rita. And so it's just somebody walks across the stage, and he was tuning up his drums. And all of a sudden, you hear this little woman just turn around to the drummer and said, "Well, you shut the bleeping up. I can't hear anything." And all of a sudden, he stopped. We realized it was Rita Moreno. And then she looks up, and then she starts laughing. She's like, "I'm just kidding. How you doing? It's so great. I sound great." And she just wanted us to ease the room. Say, "Hey, yeah, I'm still in New York, and I know you guys are too." So she's
still, "Hey, you guys." Right, yeah.
So
is there any particular person that you've worked with, either in the context of your 100 years of Broadway or conducting, or in any context, that was especially meaningful to you, or was an extraordinary experience to work with?
I'll give this story. When I was in college, I was a big Sondheim fan. And, you know, to me, he's the Shakespeare of our time. I know the public as a whole doesn't get him as much as the people who are in the theater world. I run into it all the time. I can't believe it.
Even when you tell them West Side Story, Gypsy.
No, they get that, but he wrote the lyrics for those. So, and that's a way of... that's a trick for me to let them know who Sondheim is. But, you know, Sondheim pushed boundaries, and people don't like change a lot of the time, except for people who do like change.
Yeah,
but there's no denying his genius. And So I was invited. A friend of mine was involved with the original Assassins.
At Playwrights Horizons.
So I was at opening night. As a matter of fact, the New York Giants 1990 Super Bowl was that exact day, and I gave it up. And I'm a huge sports fan. I couldn't believe the Giants got in, and I gave it up to go see Assassins with Stephen Sondheim, you know, there. And at the after party, I was so nervous to speak to him. And he said, oh, Neil, Stephen, this is young composer Neil Berg. Neil, this is Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be one of those jerks who just gushed and gushed. And we were at the buffet table. He had a chip in his mouth. So I said, Mr. Sondheim. He goes, yes. I said, so how's the dip? And he said, not too spicy. End scene. I walked away.
Oh,
I didn't know what else to
say.
And then, flash forward, I'm producing Closer Than Ever by Maltby and Shire last year in New York.
Right, and it was a hit.
Big hit. We win the best off-Broadway revival. And by the way, David Shire was my other guy who I revered. You know, one of the most brilliant writers of music and Richard Maltby of lyrics that we've ever seen. But they were always in the shadow of Sondheim at that time, except for the people in the business who know them. Mm. And, of course, they're buddies. So Stephen came to my show, and I sat literally, you know, right in front of him. And I got a chance to go up and say to him, hey, by the way, a long time ago I was at Assassins. I asked you how the dip was. I just want to tell you what you've meant to me. And you know,
so you did get to gush.
I did get to gush. And that was on the producing side of it. And Josh Groban came to see it. And that was cool because Josh Groban told me that the show I produced in New York, Closer Than Ever, he used that song to get one of those songs to get into Carnegie Mellon.
Oh.
And so that was really cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, and even working with, you know, now, you know, David Shire is one of my best friends. I can't believe that the guy I revered growing, you know,
right.
is now, you know, lives a few miles away from me. And we go out for dim sum, you know, on Sunday with his beautiful wife, Didi Khan.
Frenchie,
Greece. Yeah.
Oh, my God. And it is a small business. Let me ask you, Neil Berg, before I let you go, because I know you have a sound check coming. But are you... Oh, what I just forgot what I was going. Oh, producing. Now that you've done Closer Than Ever, and then, of course, you're touring this production, are you going to get more into producing other shows?
Absolutely. I love plays just as much as I love musicals.
Cool.
And my agent just happens to be also represent one of the greatest writers, Jordi Galceron. Now, in the United States, we don't know Jordi. But he's known as one of the greatest writers in the world, living in Lisbon right now. Mm. He writes mainly in Spanish. So my producing partner, Adam Friedson, and I have taken a big interest. One of his plays just had a big hit in Washington, D.C.
In translated?
And it was in Spanish, but they had the subtitles.
Oh, okay, cool.
So we are getting involved. And then through that process, now he asked me to write a musical with him.
Oh.
So my producing and writing is coming into the same area. I was started off producing another musical called Never Grimm that I was writing.
G-R-I-M-M?
Yes. Or,
right,
yep.
Okay.
A little pun on the, you know, the Grimm fairy tales with a brilliant writer, Jonathan Felben, who wrote the movie Swing Kids.
Oh, okay, cool, yeah.
And that's being produced now by the big film producer Mark Gordon, who produced Saving Private Ryan.
Oh my gosh.
And Swing Kids, Jonathan's film. So, you know, I've been getting involved now with some big-time producers on that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I see something, and on a small little level, just last week, I started working with Henry Gross. Now, people are saying, who is Henry Gross? And that's going to be my marketing. Do you remember Henry Gross? Henry Gross was the founder and youngest member of Sha Na Na. He was 18 years old when he played Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
He left Sha Na Na to become a songwriter. He had a huge hit. He defined the one-hit wonder of the 70s with a great song he wrote called Shannon, about a dog that has lost its seat. If anybody remembers, Google and listen to it. Shannon by Henry Gross.
Okay.
And he has a fascinating story. He lives in Nashville. He's worked with everyone. He was backstage with Jimi Hendrix. You know, Bob Garcia did get him stoned at Woodstock. Bob Garcia is another friend of mine who's in the record business. So Jerry Garcia got him stoned at Woodstock. So by the time he got on at Shannon, he could hardly see. You know.
Welcome. Where
It's a fascinating story, and it's a one-person show. So I just signed on. I'm going to be producing that. And I'm going to do that at the APAP conference in January in New York to see if we can get that picked up.
Nice, nice. So last question for our guest, producer and composer and multi-hyphenate, Neil Bird. What are your hopes for your career and for musicals in general, even, over the next 10 years, let's say?
I already feel like I hit the lottery. I make a good living.
Knock wood, yeah.
In theater, doing what I love to do. I do it with people who I adore, respect, love. My goal was never to make money at the beginning. I was a starving artist in my 20s. All I wanted to do was work with the best people, and I get to do that. So I have a sense of fulfillment that is true and honest. But it's more like Sondheim, the blank page, a blank canvas. It's always white. Whatever comes next. And so, yes, would I love that The 12 became this big Broadway international hit? Of course I would. But, if it isn't, then I have another show coming up after that. And just the process of creating and getting my thoughts and expressing myself, I think any true artist, that's what they want to do the most. And then you let people see if they identify with it in some way. But to just keep evolving as an artist, as a creator. But in all this talk of art, I'd like to finally say this. I personally, you've got to love yourself. People say that. But for me, once I decided to have a family, I have a beautiful wife.
Who is an actress.
Right? Rita Harvey. And we have a wonderful 9-year-old son. And if I just had them, that would be enough. So I feel like the fact that I have all these worlds around me, I feel like I've won the lottery 2 times over. So.
Well, I feel just as lucky to have people like Neil Bird in the neighborhood. Do be on the lookout for the various shows that he's doing. If you're here in Colorado, obviously The 12 is coming up at Denver Center next season in 2015.
It'll be opening at March 27th at the Denver Center.
Yeah. March 27th
in Denver. In 2015, yes.
Yeah, and also look out for 103 Years of Broadway, wherever you are listening to this program, because he does 80 to 120 concerts a year all over the country.
Every nook and cranny.
Thank you for visiting our nook of the neighborhood, Neil Bird.
Thank you, Dave.